Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Many of us reach this stage of life thinking we know who we are. Then life quietly asks us to look again. My guest today is retired history teacher and memoirist, Lee Knapp. She has spent her career studying history, only to discover that some of the most important lessons weren't found in textbooks, they were found in her own life. Our conversation wanders through faith, family, race, marriage, divorce, purpose, late life love, and the surprising freedom that comes from questioning assumptions we've carried for decades. One thing Lee says has stayed with me ever since we recorded this conversation. She isn't sure she likes the word reinvention. She prefers to think of it as revelation, discovering the person who has been there all along. I think many of us will recognize ourselves in that idea. Listen now to my conversation with Lee Knapp. Today's guest has spent a lifetime studying history, only to discover that some of the most important lessons weren't found in textbooks. Lee grew up in Virginia during a time when many assumptions about race, religion, relationships, and identity simply went unquestioned. Years later, after returning to teach history at the very high school she once attended, she found herself face to face with a very different America, one that challenged her beliefs, expanded her understanding, and ultimately reshaped her life. Along the way, she navigated a spiritual awakening, a painful divorce after more than 3 decades of marriage, an honest reckoning with her family's past, and an unexpected late life love story that doesn't follow traditional rules. Her memoir, I'm History, But Do I Repeat Myself? I love that title. It explores the ways our personal stories intersect with larger cultural shifts and how reinvention often begins when we're willing to look honestly at ourselves. Lee Knapp, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast, where we are embracing the journey.
Well, thank you for having me. This is exciting.
I am so looking forward to this conversation. I'm going to start with a question. You describe yourself as someone who spent a lot of time thinking about the baby boom generation. What do you think people misunderstand about us most?
I think there's a lot of envy, actually, in some ways. A young colleague of mine said that we all went through the golden age of childhood when things were simpler, playing outside till your mother called you in, riding your bike all over creation and just having so much freedom, And so, I mean, plus there's so many of us. My youngest son is a finance guy, and he always talks about how we used up all the resources, which I always tease him that no, we did not. That they're, we didn't buy $5 coffees, if you know what I mean.
Well,
So
I'm
I
going to
think,
interject there too, because does he look these statistics up on his computer that didn't
Oh,
ex that
yes, exactly. Right,
older
right,
generations actually developed for him?
right, right. But I do think, I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of criticism that I see, except that, we are such a huge generation and the resource thing, but there was an awful lot of innovation. However, I do think the baby boomers changed from David Brooks wrote that book called Bohos in Paradise, I think it was. And he talks about, the bohemian went to the bourgeois, over our generation, where we started out, not really wanting material things, and then became a massive consumer, cohort in the economy. And I mean, I'm right there. I think materialism is my new religion. No.
Well, it's funny because, I can think of people who back in the 70s that I went to university with, and they were dope smoking, who knows what else. And now they're ultra conservative. And I go like, what happened? Oh my
Right, right,
goodness, yeah.
right. It rarely goes the other way. What's the Churchill quote? If you're 20 and you don't have a heart, something about you don't have a brain. If you get to be 40, and you don't want money or whatever, you don't have a brain. Like it's you're just switching because you get more, I guess that's a part of the boomer thing that you're getting at is, where do we lose? Where along the way do we lose that freedom? And trusting in the future without having it all planned out, even though I've been a planner and, control freak a little bit my whole life. But I don't know. Sometimes I feel like coming back, at this age, I'm 68, that there is a return of that little girl freedom. Is it Catherine Northrup, I think her name. She was on Oprah a long time ago, and she talked about the wisdom of menopause. And it really, I never forgot it. It was like you are returning back to being almost your pre-menstrual self or whatever, where you have, or post-menstrual, thank God. you have that essence, your true essence comes out. And that's a lot of the story that I was trying to capture in my memoirs, just sort of in all these different areas of my life, I got more and more and more freedom, inner freedom to be myself, after years that maybe men feel this too. I have three sons, two brothers, five brothers-in-law, nephews. I mean, I do have four nieces, but now I have three grandsons. So sometimes I'm guilty of making those blanket statements, but I do think women deal a little bit more with doing what is expected of them, and putting yourself a little sometimes secondary. It's very subtle, but yeah. So it's kind of nice to, come back and have that freedom of the baby boomer early years, And my sons actually do sometimes wish that they came along at a time. It's really ironic without technology. I don't know about your friends, but and I didn't, I mean, I was a goody-goody. Like you open the dictionary at the word goody-goody, there's my picture. So I never went across country hitchhiking, but I knew a lot of people that did. And so my boys think it's just fascinating that you just get in a car, have a map, maybe, Well, I'll talk about him later, but Mark, my companion, he just went down to Florida when he was like 21 and ran out of money. And he just went and found a guy, did some construction work to get some money, found a girl to live with for a little while. Just his mother didn't know where he was, this whole kind of thing. Anyway, it's kind of, fun. But anyway, so yeah, so things have definitely changed in our boomer, the span of our boomer lives. Think of what we've seen. I used to think my grandfather saw horse and buggies because my grandfather, a lot older, to a man on the moon. Okay, that's pretty big, but I do feel, just to pat ourselves on the back as boomers, like we've seen so many, not just technology, but so many social changes, And generally speaking, at least the people I know have gone with it. They kind of like it. To see some of those, the idealism that I write about in the book, the idealism that we had in the 70s, particularly what I use the microcosm of my high school, kind of came true. It wasn't just an ideal, it became real, where there's just multi-ethnic kids all in this classroom, like a little model of the whole country. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to stay back in the 70s for now. The woman who graduated from Tucker High, was it in 76?
Correct.
Okay. What assumptions about life then seemed unquestionable?
Well, back then, I still am in terms of faith. So I had a born again conversion experience at when I was 15 in my own bedroom with this woman, and some friends, and it was very genuine. I had to think long and hard when I was writing to not go back and change that narrative because of the way things have gone in, society in that regard, in terms of evangelical faith. And so for me in those years, because I had been in, Bible studies and youth group, however, the whole orientation of faith at that point was also kind of the radical Jesus. The countercultural Jesus, the poor Jesus, who looked after the poor and so forth. And so we were kind of following along in that, not conservative, I mean conservative in the small c, not behavior based. I would go to this youth group thing and everybody's smoking on the front yard, smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so what? As time went on, that told the mothers of the kids that totally changed. That would have been considered, a heathen or whatever. So yeah, I think I set out with this idea that God was on my side. And I was kind of on an, I don't know, like an upward spiral. It was deeply, deeply down in there. And I thought if I did everything right, I talk about defensive perfectionism in my life, whereas my mother was, we were very close. I loved her, but there were issues at times of her, taking advantage of me and so forth, because I had a very delinquent brother. So she relied on me to talk to and so forth. And boy, you did not want to incur her wrath. And so my response was to be perfect. So that was my defense, was to be perfect. In other words, don't give anybody anything they can hold against you. So, but that ties you up in knots. And so I think I started out with this idea that I am going to be, I mean, I wouldn't have said I'm going to be perfect, but I'm not doing anything wrong.
I know my own dad was let's say Victorian almost. He was much older. He was an older father. And I just call it staying under the radar. Like it's just if nobody sees you, nobody notices you, you can't get in trouble for anything.
Absolutely. I'm a middle child. I don't know if you were, but
I was youngest, yeah.
youngest. Oh, well,
Yeah.
that's true. That's what I did. Although it was hard for me because I was the only girl and in between two brothers, and the older one was all, he had like what 19 criminal counts against him before he was 18, and he got kicked out of school at eighth grade because he was so bad. And so they didn't know, to be gracious, parents didn't know as much about how to, not talk to the siblings about the troubled kid. You should talk to your friends or whatever.
Yeah,
But
therapist, yeah.
yeah, so that was kind of one of the things I started out with, attitudes, I should say.
Okay. Now your book weaves your personal story with larger cultural history. At what point in time did you realize that those two stories couldn't really be separated?
Well, I think it's this idea that in our identities, we think, I do, I should say for myself, you think, oh, you're such an individual, you come up with all these things, the way you think are completely from yourself. But then you forget that you live in a culture and that these ideas are affecting you. And so, for instance, to start with the faith chapter, which is the beginning, I realized that, oh, I'm not the only one who fell into this sort of, it wasn't a cult, but it was a very much of a subcultural type of church with a very controlling minister. And I know a lot of people have had this experience. This was way back in the 70s. And then I started learning more history. And I was like, oh, well, this is what happened in the Puritan colony. And it was Roger Williams that I write about who finally threw his hands up and said, we each have something called soul liberty, that God has made people unique. And he even ends up just like giving up on, converting the Native Americans because he said they have their own conscience and they actually are doing very well. So that was one area. And then of course, the biggest area of the book is definitely with race. I mean, I'm in Richmond, Virginia, and if your listeners don't know, they probably do. It was the capital of the Confederacy in the American Civil War. And so we had statues until not long ago, like 5 years ago, we had statues of all the Civil War generals, the losers, And it definitely defined the city. It defined my life. It defined my high school because when the Supreme Court ordered for schools to integrate, Virginia in the 50s and on into the 70s resisted that in any way, shape possible. The white legislators, came up with this thing called massive resistance. and made it almost impossible for Black families to actually attend a school, you know. So it was a lot, and I try to, in the book, I try to, because I am a history teacher. I mean, you just can't get it out of you. But because I taught teenagers, I was trying to make it not detailed at all. Just the history in the book is very to the point and very related to my history. So yeah, that part of coming back to my high school in 03, when I left in 76, it was, let's just say I had 400 students in my class, and maybe five or six were Black. And then I come back and it's 40% Black, 40% white, and then 20% from literally all over the world, speaking 37 different languages. And so that became my metaphor of just like America, same real estate, entirely different population. But it was very rewarding to see what these old geezers, hate to say it, feared. And we can really take a lesson right now in America. What they feared happening happened organically. It was just the way they kept redrawing the lines and so forth. And I mean, kids are kids. It was the most beautiful part of my career, was to see these teenagers make friends with each other. It did not matter their background. I used to say, if you're funny, okay, I like you.
You walked back in after 30 years, going from one extreme to the other. Can I ask you, what was your first emotional reaction to that?
Well, my husband at the time, I needed to go to work. I had been doing artwork in my house. I did a bunch of clay things, you know, little models and sculptures and all this. And I just re realized I needed to get a what do you call it? Consistent job. I think that's what they call it, a job. And so I was kind of desperate, and I looked on this website and it's like, oh, what do you know? A history teacher at Mold High School. Isn't that kind of lame, you know? So then I go back in, and a neighbor goes, well, you better get your bulletproof vest. And I first of all was
Yikes.
like, why did you say that? And it's like, it's my high school, you know, my alma mater. But I think it was coming from that person's stereotypes. So, and it was a campus style school where there are all these little buildings with sidewalks and outdoor. And, you know, as soon as I set foot on the campus, I'm like, there's nothing to be afraid of. This is great, you know. But it was like very different from the 70s.
Now you write that your students exploded and rebuilt parts of your identity. Does any one student stand out?
Oh, there's, I call it, I don't know about you, but when you get older, I find I use the word cute and little a lot. I mean, even like we went on a tour and the woman was like 50, and I go, oh, she was such a cute little woman. She's like
Oh, my
50.
problem is the
Oh,
doctor that looks 15.
I know. It doesn't give you much confidence. It's true. Well, there's this student named Karina, and she went on to be this great graphic artist. She lives in San Francisco. And when she was applying for colleges, I happened to be going to see my son in Brooklyn, New York, and she was going to apply to Pratt Institute. So she's from an Indian background. She's Zoroastrian. And then her dear friend Pin was Vietnamese. And so those two girls hopped in my car and we drove to New York and stayed with my good friend. And she had the best personality, huge potty mouth. I wrote in the book that she taught her architect mother to cuss. And she'd say, you're full of sheet. So anyway, so she stands out for sure. So I don't know. There's just so many though. And then there was a boy named Rajan this past my last year, and other teachers had warned me about him, and they go, well, don't worry, if he feels you like him, you know, he'll behave for you. But he was just so had so much personality, but we got along really well. And then one time I saw him on the sidewalk after he let you know graduated, and I don't know, it sounds, you know, self-serving to say this, but boy, did it make my heart jump. He goes, Miss Knapp, I think about you all the time, you know,
Oh,
and that's just what every teacher loves to, you know, and I go, me too, because he was, you know, he was funny and asked good questions and so forth.
yeah. Okay, so if your 20-year-old self or your 18-year-old self were to sit down with your 68-year-old self in a diner booth for 2 hours, what would be the biggest argument?
That I was such a know-it-all in a very nice way. And that pretty much back then, this sounds so funny, like you say, because you change so much. Like, if everybody would just accept Jesus into their heart, then all the problems of the world would go away. I mean, just the massive naivete. So that would be one. Also, I probably would have lightened up a bit. I mean, I was very prudish. I was every guy's good friend. You know, I fulfilled that role. I was the one, you know, like, hey, homecoming dance coming up and all. You think you could ask Susan if she might go with me? You know, I was that girl.
Okay.
So I might have been a little more schooled in social things a little bit, but I just never had the confidence. In when I was 18, and I had very, very strong women, my mother, my grandmother's sister, my her great aunt, my great aunt Dizzy, we called her. I'm telling you, if I ever did anything with a boy, particularly, I mean, it just would not have fit with my whole personality or anything. Anyway, yeah, so that would be one of many things, yeah. And just the whole idea of things don't, you plan as much as you want, but things, you cannot control other people in your life. It's a biggie.
One of the themes that keeps on appearing in your story is accommodation. The ways we learn to adapt, stay quiet, avoid conflict. Don't we all, identify with that? When did you realize that that accommodation was just becoming too expensive?
Well, with my mother, I was 45 and she was 80. So she was only going to be alive another 10 years. I didn't know that then, but I just remember just again, it's when you write or when you talk about your life, when you're summing it up, I think it's so important not to be black and white about your memories. Casting a person completely this way or the other, but you only have so much time. So, no, but so in other words, we were very close. But again, this thing with my brother and the, you know, she would kind of act like I was his mother and I should be just as upset at all his, just criminal, literally criminal behavior. And so it just got to a breaking point, and I visited her like I always did on the back porch of her house, 8 miles from my house. Not to mention, we talked on the phone almost every day, you know. So I just told her, I think a lot of people have come to this point. If you want to have a relationship with me, you're going to have to stop making it about my brother. This is not healthy. So it was a feeling of being taken advantage. Obviously, taken advantage of. And then there were things in my marriage that were definitely in the exact same category that I read. I think I heard one of your previous podcasts about competence, maybe with someone talking about when you are very competent, you do things sort of with ease, and other people can easily take advantage of that. I used to say it's kind of like a heat-seeking missile, you know, they're out there and they're just like trying to find somebody to do something for them. And when you're, at least when you're younger, you know, so I had to, I actually ended up getting divorced, stemming out of that accommodation that wasn't coming back my way. And I was having very, very many stress-induced physical symptoms from, and it so it kind of got to be a health thing. Yeah. So yeah, that was accommodating. And you know, someone made the point about in history, you know, we accommodated in the in America in the American South. And I mean, although racism was all over America, it wasn't just, you know, although definitely centered here, you're accommodating the racists, you know. And we see quite a lot of accommodation going on, not to go there, but right now. I mean, you have people doing bad things in our personal lives, and you have people doing bad things in our collective life, but then you have those other people who just stand by and you know, let it happen. And it's this, I've been hearing people talk lately, like, well, you know, who's more guilty? Or they're probably just as guilty. And so it's probably important for us to all like step up and not accommodate. Well, you can be nice about it, but just, you know, not accommodate. It's not good for the other person to take advantage of you.
I know there was more than a few times when I said to my own children, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, but it's done now, is if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So when you're just
Definitely.
standing there watching something happen, you
Right,
know,
right.
it's.
It's the idea you said with some other guests, you know, you put yourself second. I mean, mothers do that, and you have to. I mean, in a lot of cases, but there's a lot of joy in giving. It's a lot of joy in being a mother and doing things. But when it crosses over to someone like taking advantage, you know, like I said, and I went to this one therapist once, or a couple times actually, that my ex-husband had gone to. And he made a great point about you have an image of yourself. And when these relationships and how they've been going don't match the image that you have of yourself, then you kind of get it doesn't make sense. And you can't, he goes, make meaning of your life because you've set up this story about yourself and then other people aren't relating to you. And he was saying, you know, you have to look at these moments that are frozen. He used the word frozen moments in your past and confront them, you know, either the people or come to some sort of, what's the word, you know, resolution about some of that.
A lot of our peers, women this age, you know, we spent probably decades being who everyone else expected us to be. Do you think they, or perhaps you take it as personal as you want to, miss signs that a marriage is faltering because they're just so busy being who everybody expects them to be?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I heard you also say, because I listened to several of your podcasts about, you know, you got to ask your friends sometimes, you know, because you don't notice things. Either they help you, like, oh, you're really good at this, or they can say, well, have you noticed how you get interrupted all the time? Which was something a friend of mine said one time. So yeah, I think it just takes a while to see some of those things, you know. And like you say, when you are competent, you feel like you can handle it. But my situation happened more when my kids were gone. So and it was very obvious. And I think my emotional tank was so dry, and not to mention some of the behaviors that I write about in the book that he was doing. So, you know,
I like that analogy. Like the tank is just dry,
Yeah,
nothing left.
right.
And
Right.
once the kids are gone, you know, you look at this person across the table and you're like, who the hell is that?
Yeah, right.
You know, so, but reinvention sounds more, you know, pretty exciting in hindsight. But do you remember what it felt like when you were actually living through it?
Oh, yes. Again, the notion of freedom, you know. I'm like a lot of folks. I mean, I think at heart, I'm an artist. And one of my secondary goals is that being a teacher is a form of art. And I just really wish more kids that were motivated and, you know, smart, I just wish they'd consider the profession. I ended up teaching a lot of very smart kids, and it was disappointing when you'd say, well, what do you want to do? You know, So, and they would never, architect, doctor, lawyer, never a teacher. When I said, oh, what about a teacher? And they'd start laughing. But yeah, I just felt that freedom. And I was going to say, as an artist, that's the number one thing you need is inner freedom to explore every idea, every, color, everything anything you're working, all the materials, And so, because of my previous situation, I just felt restricted. Again, it's all very subtle and not articulated at the time. So when I would not have to leave school and rush home to see what's going on, I could just, see my friend or just take my time or putz around the house doing what I wanted. So that was one thing. I don't know. It was just also, I do have a little, it's a good word, reinvention, but I have this thing about applying technological terms to our human condition, because it's almost like, for me anyway, if I reinvented, it's as though I did it. I sat down with the blueprint and said, this is how I'm going to invent myself again. I didn't invent myself in the first place, in a way. I was just more on a path of discovery in my earlier life. And so it's kind of been more like organic to see this next phase as what is being revealed to me in my inner self and also in the world around me. So even though it's still a really good word, it's kind of
So is it more
like,
of a revelation then? You
yeah, right.
okay.
A new
That makes sense.
revelation. Yeah,
Yeah.
I know that I used to teach when they did the scientific revolution. They started talking about a clockmaker God and people as computers. And there's something to that, but it sort of diminishes somehow. That our ultimate humanness. We have to be really careful right now that with the whole AI thing, even though I don't understand it, but that we don't. Everyone's talking about this. Don't lose our humanness. In the face of all this incredible technology, we're still human beings, So, yeah.
This is totally going sideways here, but I remember you just you talking about we are people and so don't use these technological computerized scientific terms. And I was thinking, I remember confronting, well, I shouldn't say confronting. I asked a guest if by anthropomorphizing animals in stories for children, whether we were doing children a disservice. And so it's interesting how this human condition runs right up the middle. So,
That's a good point, yeah.
but, okay, so there's someone in the audience who's feeling restless, isn't quite identifying what's going on. Are there questions she could ask herself?
You mean in terms of are
Trying
you
to figure out
getting?
what's going on.
Yeah. I think, if you are getting what you need from others as much as you feel you're giving, and if you're a person that is highly competent, oh, that was another thing I was going to say about the baby boomers. I do think we were very competent mothers and doing a ton of things at once. Not that they're not now, but so I guess that would be something if I were to speak to younger women, it would be to really examine, are you living here's another cliche, your truth, but I think that really just means, are you living according to what you want to be doing? I felt trapped, and sometimes I still do, by money. I was just obsessed with, are we going to have enough money? And that was another part of stuff that was going on with my marriage. So oftentimes I'd do something like I'd made things out of clay. So I call myself the ceramic whore. You want to do it in clay? I'm your girl. I would do anything, make any little replica. And so sometimes I would say, just really look deep at what you would like to do. And I know it's not always true and it sounds very Oprah, but the money will follow. But I think just enough money will follow. So one thing that happened to me was I got this brainstorm in a gift shop once. I don't know. I was probably 35 or yeah. And it was some cufflinks that look like typewriter keys. And I've seen them in the, since then. And this whole idea about grammar, I'm certified in English and history. I was like, oh my gosh, what if I created a line of products that emphasized good grammar, but in a funny way? And so I started hand painting them, and then all my other like hand-built clay things, I started adding this to it. And one thing led to another. And I ended up getting these little decals made. And that's been, I didn't know where it was going to go, and that ended up being not at all a big business. I make every single one of them. But right when I needed it the most, I got a phone call out of the blue. Like, I know every person listening to this of a certain age can look back, on wow. And this lady had seen them in a store, the one store I had them in California. She saw them and she was like a gift agent, and she would take your things to big shows in New York and all that. And she said, would you be interested in me representing you? And it was amazing. So it wasn't that much money, but it was just enough, to make, because I was on my own 100% financially. And then also part of the past was wanting to have this big house, not me. And it's out in the country and so forth. And my now, unfortunately, late daughter-in-law said, oh, Lee, there's this thing called Airbnb. And that was another thing out of the blue that I had a little room over there that was perfect. It was its own little space. And I just put a door up and I rented the room out. And then I started renting the whole house out. And that just kept me going, So that would be the thing of there's, I guess for all of us, there are actionable things you can do after you've gotten in touch with yourself. You can take a class or, do something. But this is sort of that's what I mean about the organic part of reinvention. Then there's that moment like, oh, wow, this is cool. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know. I love those kinds of stories when people, it seems like everyone has one at some point.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people would sort of say, when you're open to the universe will talk to you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's interesting because being open to the universe isn't necessarily a physical thing. It's that fine, that blurry line, I guess, of how do you do that? I'm going to go back to your faith for a moment. How did you l learn to separate faith from authority?
So good. Well, I don't know. I was a goody-goody, like I said, but I also had this other anti-authority streak in me because if somebody told me to do something that I didn't think was right, even though I was little, it was this idea almost like you want to, speak up and say, well, justify this, to me. And so in the early days, like I said, it was really fun and, open. But then that church experience, this guy was so controlling. He told me I had the spirit of Jezebel. He had a, I know, I was like, join the club. I was proud of that. And then leaving there and then just, yeah, you're right. As far as thinking about your faith, whatever that faith is, as a relationship and not a subculture, that can oftentimes, not always, come with a certain language. And then you find yourself, all you're doing is participating in those activities. And so I felt like it was okay to have a faith that is right for me. But then I do believe that having all those students from different religions from all over the world kind of took away the singular focus of one authority about God. And so, at least in my tradition, well, in every religious tradition, I'm pretty sure this is true. There is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's pretty everywhere. So it'd be pretty arrogant of me to claim any kind of in with God when I am supposed to just love God, love other people, do unto others. That's enough to have to fulfill. And seeing all these other families at my school, because parent teacher night was so touching. You have parents from all over the world, and many of them ended up in Richmond, Virginia, was the most provincial place at one point. And here they just want their kid to do well. They love their child just like we love our kids. Everybody loves their kids. And there's the story that is in the promotional stuff about this one boy that he got four Fs on his report card. He's Pakistani. And he said, my three uncles are flying over from Pakistan right now
Oh my
to
gosh.
question me about my report card. And I go, oh, you're joking. He goes, no, I am not joking. So it really hit me like, oh, my boys have uncles. You know what I mean? It's just so when the whole question about authority, I guess in a way, I just threw my hands up about that and decided that I was just loving the world as I was seeing it again on this little microcosm. Teenagers are hilarious. I know it, most teachers are in the camp of, oh, I could only teach elementary. And then, the other, I could only teach high school. And so I definitely, I would go crazy at teaching elementary school, even though they are the real heroes. But I mean, teenagers are just, they're unfiltered and they're learning about things and they ask good questions without all the, societal things. So anyway, that's a long answer, but that's how I am. that, the authority thing isn't really part of faith in a way. That's part of institutions.
But if it's ingrained, I'm just thinking about, women who may be our age or almost our age or even older than us, and with that authority, questioning authority, guilt comes along. That's the next thing. Is there anything that we could say, you could say, that can sort of say, like, how to disrobe from the guilt?
The guilt, yeah. That's a good question. And so I want to be really clear because I have a lot of very dear friends. They're the best people in the whole world who I came through different churches with, they are truly free. And I think those are the ones who have not relied on the authority. And so I think it really maybe, I don't know, is a function of self-awareness and also self-love because, and also knowing that we're not perfect, of course. So just approaching the world with, being kind to yourself so that you can then love other people. But maybe, like you say, just looking at ways to free yourself of these influences that are not allowing you to be yourself. But with a word that we need more of now, like with grace towards that other person. I just let myself in my early years feel as though I had to justify everything and I didn't trust my own instincts. And like everyone had to think exactly alike within an institution or whatever. And I kind of definitely got over that. I don't know. Life has a way of slapping you across the face a little bit. Sort of wake up, but yeah, I mean, I guess in a sense, I was talking to my daughter-in-law, like maybe everything about this life is just one big metaphor. And so those of us who have kids, I don't know, at least for me, I don't know. They just fascinated me, like where did you come up with that comment when they were little or even now? They're 44 down 44, 42, 40 young men. And they still fascinate me. So I want my children to just function in their freedom and be just whatever they are. And I don't know if you want to say God or the universe. I would imagine that's kind of what that force wants from us so that we can be very effectual, in the world. because of who we are. There's the last page of that section of the book. There's four sections, and there's this old Russian philosopher I found a long time ago named Nikolai Berdyaev. And he was saying that, what we ultimately are is a personality, and that one day we won't have a body, but it's our personality that's just like the key thing, and you need to have, he says something like, you need to have ultimate freedom. Just a cavern of freedom so that that personality can be fully expressed. And it's probably a lifelong journey to get to that point, for most of us, unfortunately. Or it could just be the fact that when you get old, they talk about your filters just fail. So you start saying whatever you want to say.
Mine don't fail. I got rid of them.
Oh, see, that's good. Yeah. It's intentional. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah, and it's interesting with children. I'll just stick with children, then I'm going to go back up the forbear ladder. But I remember telling my children that they were welcome to disagree, they were welcome to argue, they could question all that sort of stuff as long as they weren't rude. You have to be polite. As soon as you're rude, you're wrong. But okay, so you've talked about your mother, your grandmother, your great aunt. Oftentimes, we do need to look at our forebears, sometimes going back generations. How do we get around the fact that, looking at our worldview today, that several generations ago, they actually weren't nice people?
I know. Yeah, that's the that was another big motivation for me writing this, because I want to, how they say, you if you write, you know what you think. It helps you think it through. And so yeah, so my grandmother was such an influence on me. I run this Airbnb. She ran a 10 bedroom boarding house in a little railroad town. My grandfather was disabled, strongest person I've ever known in my life. And kind. However, she grew up in the American South, and there was a lynching in her town. And I tell the whole story of her talking about she had no problem with what happened. She even went to see the bodies. And I had to wrestle with, how can I love her, knowing that she failed morally? So then you go into this whole historical thing that we deal with of, can you judge people of the past based on the morality of today? They are steeped into their society. Well, I think you can in a way, because somebody at some point in time in history says, no more, this is wrong, and they stand up. I had a little posters in my classroom. Do people make history, or does history make people? So who is it among us? It wasn't my grandmother, unfortunately, who in her tiny little southern town to say, oh, this is wrong. I mean, in the 1920s. So I think I had to come to terrible, it was just that when I was writing, it was just so hard. I remember crying a lot. And she's been gone a long time, but there it's just forgiveness. You have to, and but then move on, talk about it. And it's the same with America. I talk about Martin Luther King Jr.'s calling his beloved Southland. He called the South beloved. Martin Luther King, and he was killed, and so many others. And so I this is this, we would talk about this in class, what does it mean to love America? But you, and this is very pertinent. And right now in American society, you cannot erase the past. I can't erase my grandmother, of course, but you have to just, this was a James Baldwin quote, and you have to look at the past and basically learn from it, but look at it with very, very open, truthful eyes. And with the eye to change. And so, and that to provoke people to change their attitudes is the most important thing we can do. But you have to start with an overarching ethic, in my opinion, of basically do unto others. So everything you do in your own life and in a society with our laws has to answer that question. You know, would you as a majority be willing to follow the law that you just passed on a minority? And you know, like that's a do unto others type of thing. So yeah, that was definitely very hard to know that I took so much from her personally, I guess you could say, or privately, but then publicly, the way she related to her culture was just, you know, so awful. But I know that in college, when I wrote a paper about her, I was still under this kind of spell, like nostalgia, some kind of nostalgia about, and I wasn't looking at the violent. So there's still, I mean, it's still an open dilemma, but you know, in any relationship, like I said, there is a point of forgiveness and doesn't absolve them of what they did, but you know,
Yeah.
you come to terms with it.
As I was sort of prepping for our talk today, one of the reasons that question came to mind was because I've been watching on YouTube recently, and I won't quite say binge watching, but I don't have TV. So that show, Who Do You Think You Are? And some people who go back, usually it's a number of generations and going like, oh my goodness, you know, my great great grandfather was a slave owner, or my great great grandmother was just awful. And resolving that, because you never want to think you come from bad people, like nasty, mean people. But if it's a fact that can't be changed, you have to find some acceptance somewhere. And I guess that forgiveness is probably one of the mainstays.
Right. I mean, there's a difference though, in researching the book, there was evidently a division between public morality and private morality, so that people would say, you know, oh, well, I hired a black person to work in my, like my father did, you know, or the whole faux pas thing of some of my best friends are black, but yet you would never, so that's the private thing. Yeah, you might have, you know, but you would never agree or vote for someone who wanted to make institutional public change, you know, pass laws that were for fairness, you know. And that's another thing that teaching at my school going back when it was just so wildly diverse, I mean, the kinds of friendships that you would see, you know, kids just bopping down the sidewalk on a lunch, whatever, of all different backgrounds and races and everything, I was just would sometimes just be grinning, like how these old farts would be aghast. And there was just, as we all know, people that like to stoke up fear. There's nothing to fear, you know? Anyway, so things change and they change for the better, mostly, not always, but yeah. No, that's a good show. I like that too.
Oh, okay, good. No, you've just think say things change, but history does repeat itself. Are you optimistic about where we're headed?
Well, you're in Canada, right?
But our audience is also as universal as your
Yeah.
school.
Well, good. Well, I am, and I'm normally kind of pessimistic, but I do believe in each individual citizen doing the right thing and not being a jerk, you know, like just interactions among neighbors and so forth. You know, it takes a lot to be as rude, like you were telling about your kids, or as some of the le quote leaders are being right now. And so I am optimistic that it's very Shakespearean, it's very biblical, you know, this sort of you'll be brought down when you seek power and so forth, and you don't treat people correctly or fairly. And so, I mean, I just care so much. And we all know that there have been past times in history where there's been things like this have occurred, you know, where some groups think they're better than others and so forth. So, as long as, and it's a big as long as the Constitution holds, you know, we say that, and here's my not accommodating side. Here's my argumentative side. When I wrote this in a Substack piece, you know, how Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, everybody is entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. Well, if you take that a little further, you say, how can you form a decent opinion if you don't have the facts? And so when someone is saying two sides, you got to listen to both sides. Well, if one of those sides is not following the founding document of a society, there are no two sides. I'm sorry to say, but they're wrong. You know, their actions aren't living up to, and I believe it's the same with in America, some Christians who are becoming really political or have become political and think that God and politics the same thing. It seems to me they're not actually following their founding guiding document either.
Are you putting too much faith in your founding fathers?
No, I'm putting faith, or I have put faith in the past in the ability for the Constitution to change. You know, I mean,
Okay.
it's been amended, and just again, do people make history? Just, you know, we've had heroes that come along, but I am optimistic. And Mark's heard my companion's heard me say this a lot lately. Like, a few op quote opposition leaders right now are saying, it's not just that we're going to go back to the way things were. It could be that we're going to have some pretty deep, substantial changes, maybe not right away, in our whole way we do things in America. Like, not radical, but just expanding some of the fairness that we've been missing in the last several years. Yeah.
Now, you're an historian. A couple of years ago, I interviewed another historian who, and she's an educator, who said it was necessary for young people to understand history in order to become critical thinkers. Do you agree?
Oh, amen. So I taught US history a lot, and I've taught world history from 1500 to the present, like they call it modern world. But then I got to teach this class from in the IB International Baccalaureate program that they're all over the world. And I was so fortunate to teach theory of knowledge for the last 7 years. And it's just basically a class in critical thinking. And the most provocative presentations that kids would give had to do with questions around history for sure. So you would apply certain knowledge issues, you know, like bias or experience towards a study of history, you know, like causation or correlation. And so that was, those were always the best discussions, you know, like, sort of after the Nazis, you know, the denazification of Germany, what could we learn from that? Should they have been punished? You know, all these kinds of things. Just like I thought the best one that I would emphasize was after Napoleon was beaten, they had a big conference and they invited France to come and they got a say so in what was going to happen after Napoleon. Okay, 100 years later, World War I is over. And of course, they exclude Germany and they punish Germany like crazy, and they'll have no say so in it. And then look what happens. You know, they come back 20 years later and start another war. And so it's like, well, if we ever find ourselves in a situation where, you know, you need to have a peace treaty, you probably need to have the losers at the table too. So that's just like one example to think of. But critical thinking is, this is my, educator, and maybe like your other guest, I don't know, the last, at least in America, 25, last 25, 30 years, I really feel like the educational bureaucracy has absolutely destroyed education by through testing and data. And so you measure a child's understanding not by critical thinking. But it used to be, I know they've changed a little bit. We would give the kids a test with 70 questions, 70. at the end of the whole year of American history, and they had to get 31 correct to call themselves proficient in US history. And then little by little, again, circling this whole conversation back to the 70s, I'm sure you remember sitting around talking in class, asking questions like, well, how come this has to, And as I taught, as years went on, kids didn't do that. They got used to memorizing. And where's the critical thinking? And the teachers became more and more afraid, and they're really afraid right now to ask a provocative question for fear of, I don't know, it just makes it just soapbox here, but we need to trust the professionalism of the teachers. And parents, in my opinion, would do well to just, like, if you have a 17-year-old kid, he's going to have a mind of his own, and let him think through these ideas by talking about it with his peers. So I'm hoping that that might be another one of those big changes in society that might pre, what would you call it? Come before preclude, I couldn't think of the word. Come before some of our, kind of like civic changes or political changes. Maybe we can go back to a more meaningful educational system, so that our citizens really know what is going on, well, more of them do. Yeah.
Is there something, something's a that young people understand better than adults?
I think they understand justice. Okay. I can only speak to my school, but one time it was a summer school class, actually. I only did that once to get money to go to Paris to meet my kid. I taught 6 weeks of summer school for 6 days in Paris. That was the only way I was going to get the money. But I showed them a little clip of what happened. I don't know if you know what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. We had this riot, which is 25 minutes from me. It was called Unite the Right. And they had the guys marching across the University of Virginia's campus with the tiki torches, saying anti-Semitic things. And then these brawls broke out. It was very, very racial. And this young woman reporter from VOX Vox, she gets in the car with these neo-Nazi guys and interviewing them. And, they're spewing all this stuff. And this is me as a teacher. Like, I thought that the kids should see this. These are some people that are out there. I'm talking about a classroom that's, equally black and white. So when you ask me what do teenagers, the white kids were so angry, and I was almost like personally hurt for their friends that are sitting right there, and it got them riled up. And so it was like, again, I think it was just like, this isn't fair and this is mean. They're very into like people being mean to each other, is what I thought. And just, yeah, the sensitivity. So you hope, and I guess we all look back on ourselves when we were younger and we want to. I think a lot of us have held on to those ideals in that sense, I hope so. And not get jaded by the cares of the world, and just, and also to see each person. Like, it's so easy in a classroom to see the person sitting next to you as a person and then a potential friend, And I always say, like, maybe we should just look at the whole world. Buy the world a Coke. I mean, as a potential friend that could have been in your class. I always look at young people now. Mark and I do this all the time. It's like, wait, did I teach him? Some random person downtown, you're like, oh no. Whatever background. And I think it's a good, I don't know, it's kind of a nice approach that just gets ingrained in you as a teacher. It's like, instead of being afraid of anybody, you are just, oh, just another human being. And so
It's like that little phrase that, what is it? A stranger is just a friend I haven't met yet.
yeah, that's great. That's so true. I know it sounds so Pollyannish, but it's better than the alternative.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm
Yeah.
100% behind you there. Okay, so a listener is standing at the edge of not her reinvention, but her revelation. What do you want her to know?
I would just say trust in, trust in your friends and yourself. Really get in touch with what you want to do in these great years that we have, especially in retirement. Explore things you never explored before. But like you said, spend time with your friends. I think family is good too if you're fortunate enough. My boys live all over the place. And just, be open to possibilities. We didn't talk about, but part of my rediscovery of life was, meeting Mark, who was a widow, a
Oh, we're going to
widower.
get to him. Don't
Oh, we
give us
are.
too much
Oh, okay.
information.
All right. Okay, good. So, I think it's funny. I think I don't know if this comes across, but people talk about if you have a more open stance in your person and in your face, your visage, like smiling. I think that's a it's a silly thing, but it kind of does put off, a sense of, hey, I'm open. And I do think this is that's just one of the greatest parts of being older is you just feel more confident. You know what to talk about more. I remember like being I used to fear the awkward silence, You can tell I don't fear that anymore. I have no problem talking. So yeah, I don't know about you, but like it's just fun. You go in a store and you might just strike up a little conversation, just a funny little conversation, particularly with younger people, and they're thinking, oh, look at that old lady. She's just, whatever. But so I just think that kind of attitude is it puts out, that you want to participate, you're still here kind of thing.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that you want middle-aged women to think about? Besides Mark, we're going to get to
Oh
Mark.
no, that's good. No, I think just I heard I think it was another someone that you talked to about it's so easy to feel I don't know, at least for me, useless because your life had been so structured of I mean, I had to pee when the bell rang at 10:30 or so I've had a little adjustment of feeling purposeful at this age. But I think it is probably I'm really working on this myself. Like you kind of have to go out and make it happen more than in the past when you had a job and it was already kind of ready made for you. So there's some soul searching, but also like getting on the internet and seeing what's available that you can do, to exercise whatever it is.
Be careful using the internet. That becomes
Yeah, that's true. Oh yeah.
reinvention.
You can look it up in the almanac or something.
No. Yeah, right. Okay, where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
I am my book, I'm History, But Do I Repeat Myself, is on Amazon. My business is grammarstuff.com.
Ooh, I don't have that one. Okay, keep going.
And then I made my own website of imhistorybook.com. All
There we
lower.
go. Yeah, it was the imhistory.com that I had.
Yeah.
So there it
Yeah,
is.
I do a little bit of the grammar here and there, but
Okay. And are you on social?
I'm on Facebook, just Lee Knapp.
Okay.
And oh, what am I saying? My biggest one is Substack,
Okay.
leeknapp.substack.com. And I just got some really good advice about, quote, marketing a book. And she said, no, you're not really, you're amplifying your voice. I thought that was so good because that's another thing, like to think of ourselves as a brand. It's like, here I go again, but it's kind of like, that's a business term. So when she said, no, you're not marketing your brand, you're just amplifying your voice. And Substack, it's also for me, and this has been very recent. She said, you got to write something at least once a week, and just for your, just do it organically and just keep writing. If you're a writer, keep writing. It was a simple thing to say, but it was part of my reorientation to retirement. It's like, oh, that's right. I don't have anybody making me be somewhere, but I want to keep inspired to myself. So I'm going to just keep thinking of things I'd like to explore through writing, you know. So anyway, that's the big one. And I think, you know, it's
That's
fun.
interesting too, because on sub I've been on Substack for quite a while, but because of my previous commitments, all I ever got up there was the podcast episodes. And I'm just trying to morph now into a more personal voice. And those segments are called Meanwhile in Real Life.
Oh, good. That's
Dot
great.
dot dot. Yeah,
Well,
yeah.
you're,
So, but I'm still working on that one too.
yeah.
It's not too regular. Okay, why do we buy your book?
Oh, wow. I think, like I said, it's a story of one boomer woman, which I am. I was born in evidently the biggest year of the baby boom was 1957. So it's my story that I think a lot of people can relate to in terms of this cycle we've talked about. But then I think it also examines some of the paths and the journeys that at least America has gone on in those 68 years. And again, full circle, we as a generation have seen so many changes, you know, in lots and lots of ways. But I think the most important way is socially, as a culture, and the whole expanding diversity. And just being able, you know, buy the book so that you see in this little microcosm of a classroom, basically, or a school, it's so much easier to understand and not feel threatened by or just be comforted by the future as exemplified. The last part of the book, I was subbing because I'd already retired, and the kids, I mean, you know, you have Indian kids, Asian kids, Black kids, white kids. And they're all seniors. They're all really smart. And they go, "All right, everybody go around the room. Tell where you're going to college and what do you want to do with your life?" You know? And it was so adorable, you know? And I was like, this is it. This is cool, you know? So anyway, that would be why to buy the book, to have encouragement, basically, about your own life and the course of current history.
And I haven't read it yet, but I'm thinking too, just having talked to you now, is that what you bring to that book is you're a teacher, you're an educator, you're an historian, but you've also lived the two extremes, and that path has got to shed some light on, like, for anybody in our audience who might be struggling with, you know, whether it's changes that they're trying to accept but they're having difficulty, or something like that. I can remember saying to an older woman many years ago, who was concerned about an intercultural marriage, saying, you know, you have five grandchildren. Perhaps if each one of them went out and married someone from another culture, you might get over this. Because you can't hate your own great or granddaughter-in-law or grandson-in-law.
Well,
So,
that's true. And that's another boomer thing, you know, that a lot of boomer women, if you want to call us that, they do have mixed race grandchildren. And it's just like not a thing, you hope. I mean, yeah. So yeah, that's so true.
Okay, now we're going to get to that personal question. And I'm not even going to bother asking if it's okay, like I usually do. This late life romance of yours, many women grew up believing a successful relationship meant like a traditional marriage, shared home, shared finances, da da da. You and your partner, oh my goodness, listeners, if you could see the face she's making, you and your partner have created something quite different. Personally, I think it's an ideal situation. Can we ask how you arrived at that arrangement, and what have you learned about companionship that your younger self never would have imagined?
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, he lost his wife. She was a lot younger. She died of cancer, had two teenagers, and I was divorced, you know. So he taught around the corner from me on the back side of the building. There were these little buildings with eight classrooms, and you know. And just over a period of time, like 9, 10 months, we just ended up going out every Friday night for a beer. And just, I asked a million questions, you know, and the first night. And then I remember thinking, wow, yeah, typical male, you know, but just, you know, didn't ask about me. So then the next day at school, he's like, okay, let's do that again, but then I'll ask you some questions, you know. But I think the biggest difference was he revealed some things, he told about his past. We had very, very different pasts. And I just something came in my mind. It's like, I'm not gonna judge this guy, And back from my background, it was all very Christian, and you sort of imagined yourself ending up with someone that you met at church, which would be fine, but he liked to throw back some whiskey, and he's really funny. He's a raconteur. He's always voted most favorite teacher, like very different. But I just thought, I'm not going to judge him. I'm just going to accept him. I mean, I was like 53 or 54, and I'm really glad I did. I think some people show their heart and their stance towards humanity in different ways. And he doesn't blab about it, but I know it's there. I mean, he just cared about his students, and he's just a good person, even though I had very different background than me. That's all I'll say. So yeah, I think my earlier uptightness had faded out, and when we started, we went on a trip, his final spring break when he was about to retire, and it was completely platonic. I mean, we slept in two separate double beds. We went to San Francisco and did all that, and Muir Woods, and we just like laughed. So we had a very strong foundation as friends, and it was nice that we knew a lot of the same people from the same school system, and so you had a little. But yeah, he also loved his uncles that were World War II veterans, and my father was a World War II veteran, and we shared a lot of, and so he really appreciated older people in his life, and so did I, so we shared that. And but yeah, I also had to be open to once once the it became romantic, which he's fond of saying, when the tent came off, because I wore this in San Francisco, I wore this giant black Nike. She called it tent. That was another example of like, okay, whatever. I am who I am, if you know what I mean. And then he wanted to travel, and I'm a homebody, but he lives to travel. So that was, I mean, it was not really a hard thing to get used to, but I had to get over a lot of fear, a whole lot of fear of, the airplanes and how do you know where we're going? I mean, I didn't, I got a passport at age 55. I'd never really gone anywhere. So, but since then, oh my goodness, I think we've been to Europe 11 times, and we would go. I taught school about 4 more years after him. So we would go every spring break and every summer, have just these magnificent trips that he, anyway. So, yeah, I wrote a little bit in the book about, how do you define belonging? When you have been a wife, a mother, your DNA is involved in these people. And then everything kind of crumbles, not everything, but that original identity. So how is it that you start forming a bond with someone new? I'm still fascinated by that, where someone is kind of unknown to you, and just a little by little you talk, and then before you know it, you've shared some experiences that you can talk about. I don't know. It's just becoming more familiar and being open to someone new. And then before you know it, you belong to each other. Oh, and also, like, he used to joke about, getting married. Just don't need that anymore, And I'd say, yeah, me neither. And anyway, so he has a house, I have a house, and we see each other on the weekends and different things. Like, tomorrow I'm helping cook his brother a birthday dinner, and all my kids know him and so forth, and they're happy for me. So, yeah, I think I told you like this, I think it's a new word. We have a situationship, and I've kind of heard that older women and men are doing this now. They're not combining their finances. I think that can be the death knell. You each have your independence,
Well, and
and
even moving in together can be a whole can of worms.
Oh, I know. I love my space. I'm like almost anal about it. And he has a nice space, but it's kind of fun. You know, he goes home and then he'll come back on the weekends and it'll be enough to miss him. And I'm sure, you know, men feel the same way a little bit. They like their freedom too. So anyway, it works for us. And yeah, it's been the major, major unexpected out of the blue. I had such an, I call it in the book, I had a neuter complex. I just never came off in my own brain as very female, you know? I just felt like I lived my life as Lee. And so it's just like pretty nice. Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And I think so many women are going like, oh man, yeah. Because I know when I read that, I went like, oh, that'd be perfect. So,
It's true.
okay. So your website link is in the show notes, and actually both your website links will be in the show notes. All the links will be on your page at our website. Listeners, Lee and I covered everything from race and religion to reinvention or revelation. Oh, I stand corrected. Relationships and the stories we inherit from our families. I'd love to know what resonated most with you. Have you ever changed your mind about something you once believed was unquestionably true? I know I have a bit of a list. Share your thoughts in the comments. I'd love to know. If you know someone who is navigating a life transition, questioning old assumptions, or creating a new chapter after 60, please share this episode with them. These conversations grow because listeners like you pass them along. If you're enjoying these conversations about, I'm sorry, but reinvention's part of my life, about reinvention, revelation, resilience, and what's possible in life's next chapter, be sure to follow the Boomer Woman's podcast so you never miss an episode. And I have relatively standard closings here, and every time I say reinvention, now I'm going to think of Lee. Lee Knapp, thank you for being my guest today and demonstrating that revelation doesn't happen because we abandon our history. It happens because we're willing to learn from it. And I appreciate your honesty, your curiosity, and your willingness to keep examining the stories we've been told and the stories we tell ourselves. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. This has been really fun. Like my son said one time, he went on an interview and he goes, "Yeah, we talked for 30 minutes about my favorite subject, me." But you're great. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Have a great rest of week.